Thanks. But these axioms, I'm going to talk about what an axiom is here in a second. But they were kind of born out of similar kinds of situations to what you guys are describing here. Just situations of struggle, of suffering, of pain. You guys have heard the term maybe deconstruction, which is, it's almost become a cliche now, but it describes, it's a really helpful word that describes a really disorienting and painful, often, experience that a lot of Christians go through. I've gone through a lot of deconstruction and, you know, reconstruction of faith, and it typically happens. Nobody asks for it to happen. Nobody plans it. Nobody puts it on their calendar. But it happens because something, you know, life happens to us. And all of a sudden, the framework that we had, the faith that we had to deal with life stops working for us. Right? We've got questions that we didn't used to have. What used to be so clear is now confusing. Right? Things that seem to go along with being Christian, the culture, the politics, the entertainment, didn't used to bother me, but now they really do. These are phrases that I've heard people say. I'm unlearning a lot of things. This season is starting again for me. When I first became a Christian, I couldn't get enough of church. Now it's hard to make myself go. Sayings that used to ring true and give me comfort now seem hollow and trite and flimsy. The leaders who mentored me are doubling down on conspiracy theories and all kinds of nonsense. What does that mean for what they taught me? Yeah? It's making me doubt the things that I was taught. I'm not sure I know how to trust Christians anymore. I've had too many disappointments and hurts in church. A lot of the theological questions that felt settled for me are thrown up in the air. I don't know what to think anymore. I do love Jesus, but I'm not sure I know how to be a Christian anymore. These are all things that I've heard. I don't know if you guys feel this way. Sometimes?
Yeah.
All right, good. Good. All right. Well, I'm glad, glad I'm in the right room then. Because the axioms kind of came out of a lot of these experiences for us. I remember one, I'll just share one story. This is from a while back. I used to be a worship leader at a charismatic church. And I remember getting really disillusioned with, I was pretty good at my job. And but I remember getting really disillusioned with the assumption that I had learned to inhabit and embody and support was the assumption that if people could just get like into worship, right? If they were exuberant and expressive, if they would give themselves over to singing and worship and that kind of thing, this was going to be something that caused them to grow in Christ. That was a signal or a sign that God was at work, that, you know, and so you would look at that as a worship leader, and you'd see a lot of hands in the air and a lot of, you know, even dancing and things like that. These were all supposed to be signs that God was at work in people's lives. But I became so disillusioned because so many of the people who were most expressive in worship were continually the least mature Christians that I met at that place. They were cruel and mean and unstable and immature. I was like, why isn't this working? What's happening here? There has to be something more. So it led me to ancient sources. It led me to reading the church fathers and mothers, the early church. It led me to the liturgy and the sacraments, and that's a whole other story. But it led me into a place where I had to sort of either decide I was going to jettison my faith, jettison what I believe, just eject it, you know, and try to find something else to do for a living. That's the trick when you're a pastor. It's, there's this extra, you know, like I can't just take a break from church for a month. So anyway. But eventually, or you have to do that, or you have to go through the painful experience of deconstruction, disorientation, and then reorientation, trusting that something can be reconstructed on the other side of this that makes sense of my life, that lives better. And so these axioms came out of a lot of experiences like this, experiences of suffering and of pain, disorientation, where we had to find faith that actually could live in the real world because we didn't want to double down on the old beliefs that we used to have. So this happens in lots of ways. But for us at Gravity Leadership and a lot of the people that we've coached and trained, there was a central component of this that was really vital. And it has to do with vision. So we're going to talk about paradigm. This first whole workshop is about paradigm. It's about how we see. It's about the lenses. A lot of us have glasses on. How many of you guys do have to use corrective lenses of some kind? I can see the people with glasses. Yeah, that comports with the stats. The stats say about 60% of people need corrective lenses of some kind. And so the metaphor that we like to use is that that when faith stops working for us, it oftentimes is sort of like our vision gets blurry. It's difficult to navigate the world because the lenses that we have on are not actually giving us a good read on what's real, right? What's right in front of us. And so I stumble over things because, you know, it's not because I don't believe they're there. It's because I can't see that they're there. Right? And so our vision gets blurry. What seemed clear doesn't seem clear anymore. We didn't have the right lenses to access reality. And over time, this has a drastic impact on the trajectory of our lives, unless we tend to it. So we need corrective lenses to enable us to see, to have access to that which is actually right in front of us, but we need to calibrate the light. Does that make sense? So that it comes into focus and we can see it clearly. So we need new lenses to see what's right in front of us. That's, these axioms function as a lens of kind, or seven lenses if you want to use that paradigm. We need a new paradigm, not just new practices. We need the change that we seek in our lives. Oftentimes we think we jump right to practices. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. I'm going to start praying again, I'm going to start doing this again. And those are all fine, but oftentimes it doesn't work. Right? Anybody else have this? It's not just me. Okay, good. Yeah. Oftentimes it doesn't work because we haven't changed out our lenses. We're still trying to engage in an old practice with an old paradigm, or even new practices. I'm going to adopt this new practice. But if we bring in our old paradigm, oftentimes it doesn't work because we have the wrong assumptions about what's there. So these axioms, which we're going to get to in just a second, we're going to do the first three tonight, and then we'll do the next four tomorrow. But the axioms function as lenses, and the way they function as lenses, there's a bunch of metaphors that we use here. So they function as lenses, and they function as, another way to put it is memes. Now, I don't mean funny pictures, you know, on the internet that you send around to each other, but memes are like little genetic code, a little piece of genetic code that functions in a community by, like I said, self-replicating, and it is able to be passed from person to person. And so the axioms are these language, pieces of language that when they get into a culture, they tend to reorient the culture around some things that might at first glance seem fairly obvious, but in fact can revolutionize the way that we see. So their lenses, their paradigms, their memes. And the reason that their language oftentimes enables us to see what we couldn't see before, this is why the lens metaphor I think is helpful. So a quick story about the color blue. I don't know if you guys have heard this before, but there apparently was no word in any ancient language for blue. Like, blue is never written in any ancient language. So people found this really curious, and some modern-day experiments seem to have shown that even though probably you would think the color blue existed in the ancient world, right? Probably the hue, you know, of that, you know, the roof of that building over there, which is a kind of blue. Probably that hue was, you know, being interpreted in people's brains, but it was coming into the, you know, through their eyes, through their lenses, and that kind of thing. But because they didn't have a word for it, they couldn't really see it very well. And there's a lot of evidence that shows that unless we have a word for something, we can't actually see it. Yeah. Isn't that interesting? So they did this, this psychologist did these studies with this tribe of people in Namibia called the Himba. And the Himba have, so we have like 11 words, 11 color categories. Most Westerners have 11 color categories, you know, like blue is a color category, red, yellow, green, etc., right? The Himba only have five color categories, and blue, they don't have a word for blue, and blue is not in their color categories. And so the experiments that this guy did was he would show them a series of, on a wheel, like different colors. And you look at, there's actually pictures you can look up on the internet if you look at this experiment. And then to our eyes, all of them are green except one is very clearly blue. But the Himba could not very easily distinguish that one of them was different. They would look at the circle and they'd get it wrong a lot of the times because they wouldn't be able to see blue. We, because we have a word for it, can see it really clearly. Now, conversely, isn't that weird? Conversely, they have, because of the way their color categories are organized, they have a lot more words for green, what we would see as green. They have a lot more words for it. And so there was another one where all of them were green, except one was, to our eyes, just a slightly different shade of green. And the Himba, 100% of the time, could notice the difference. But Westerners, most of the time, could not notice the difference. At least they had to look really, really closely. So, this is kind of a nerdy example. But do you guys understand what I'm saying? It's pretty interesting, isn't it? That once you have a word for something, you're able to see it a lot more clearly. The nerdy example is unto the fact that these axioms function that way in the cultures, in the churches that have adopted these axioms, they tend to function that way. So our church, we planted our church 6 years ago, and so the first axiom preview of coming attractions is God is always present and at work. Nobody gasped when I said that. You know, it's not like wow. I had no idea. So it's sort of like, well, duh, right? But once that language starts to get into a culture, now I hear people in our church, we've had 6 years of this, I hear people in our church interpret their life through that lens. I hear people at our church go through really hard things, really hard suffering. And one of the lenses they have now to be able to see what's happening is God is always present at work. And it allows them to go through their suffering in a new way, in a different way, connected to God in a new way. Because they have language for it. All right? Okay. So these axioms are sort of like language lenses about who God is, about how life works, about how God works in our lives, about who we are. And they're rooted in how Jesus saw the world. So all this stuff is rooted in the Gospels. It's rooted in what do we see Jesus show us about what it means to be God? But what do we see Jesus show us about what it means to be human? What it means to trust in God? And I think Jesus shows us a lot of those things. All right, a couple more preliminary things, and then we'll get into the axioms. An axiom is a self. The reason we call these axioms is kind of a funny way of referring to them, right? That's not a commonly used word. But an axiom is a self-evident truth, a universally accepted principle that is assumed upon which we can act or argue. That's like the dictionary definition of axiom. And so naming these as axioms is important because I think what we see in the Gospels is that Jesus seems to assume that they are axiomatic. The way that Jesus acts and the assumptions that he has in the Gospels are trusting that these things are axiomatic. This is something upon which I can argue, right? And so we had someone who was going through our training one time who were like, hey, you know, I'm not sure if all of these are true, so can they be axioms? But the point is basically to try them out as axioms. And so I mentioned experiments of trust earlier. This is really how we grow in faith, is through these little experiments of trust. And so I would encourage you, as you listen through these, to think about what would my life look like if I trusted this was axiomatic? If I just assumed this was true, what would change for me? How would life look different for me? And then oftentimes our experiments of trust can just be a little step in that direction. I don't know, maybe I do this instead of this. Well, try that. Do that, you know. You don't need to be intellectually or mentally certain about anything before you try it. You know, just try it. Try it for a week. You know, live as if God is always present and at work for a week and just see how it goes. You know, money back guarantee, right? You, what do you have to lose? You know, you wasted you wasted a week. You've wasted plenty of weeks. Everybody has, right? It's fine. So I'm being a little cheeky, but that's what we mean by calling them axioms. These emerged for us over time as we noticed that our lenses had been changing, and the people we were training, we noticed we needed to name these things because they came to our training with different assumptions. And there was a lot about what we were training leaders to do that didn't work. It wasn't working. And as we explored, why isn't this working? We were like, oh, we're operating on different, something has shifted for us that we need to name and we need to declare and we need to put it out into the water as a meme, as a language lens, so that it can like replicate and begin to do work in a community. And that's what we're trusting and hoping that it's going to do over the course of the next year as we work together. So this gets to what you were saying a little bit, just that this... There's a sense in which these axioms can be a really powerful way of bringing a community together under some common assumptions about how God works in the world, because that's really what it's all about as a church. So as you listen to these, this will be part of our interaction, okay? As you listen to these, be open to being surprised or confused or maybe even sad or angry. All of that's okay. Like, this happened regularly to people when they listened to Jesus. And so just assume that it's part of your life of discipleship. Getting confused and disoriented. In fact, discipleship can be looked at as a series. If you just look at the disciples, actually in the Gospels, and what happened to them, their discipleship was a series of disorienting events. And the disorientation came to them because they were being faithful. They were being obedient, so they got disoriented, right? It was God's gift to them. Was, right, here's some more confusion for you. It's really important, right, for us to pay attention to those feelings of disorientation, confusion, frustration, even anger. Anger is a really important one to pay attention to. So pay attention to those things. If you sense disorientation or confusion, I just encourage you to stay present to it. That's a sensation you've got in your body. Just stay present to it and just become curious about it. Huh. I wonder why this is here. What is this telling me? Right? What is this telling me about this axiom? What is it telling me about my life? What is it telling me about my beliefs? What's it telling me about my assumptions? It's all very normal in the life of discipleship. We can trust that God's present and working in the midst of that, which is our first axiom. All right. You guys ready to go? Mm-hmm. All right. Feel free to ask questions. This is a small enough group that we can just sort of, I don't think we need like a super, organized and formal question and answer time. I will stop and see if anybody has questions, but feel free as we go forward to do that, okay? If you have something that comes to mind. All right, so that's the first axiom.
You guys want to write it down?
God is always present and working. I'm putting in shorthand up here. Always present. Oh, that's going wrong. Present and at work. Good job. God is always present and at work. The reason this is an axiom, you could maybe think about what assumption or axiom would this challenge? And for me, I think it challenges the assumption that a lot of us have that we're in charge of kickstarting our discipleship. We're in charge and responsible for making sure that we stay on God's good side. We're in charge of making sure we're growing in faith. We're in charge of those kinds of things. I think this is a contrast to that. No, God is always present. God is always working. God's not waiting around for us to get our act together before he's going to be working. St. Teresa of Avila said this, "All difficulties in prayer can be traced to one cause, praying as if God were absent." Have you ever prayed as if God were absent? I catch myself doing this all the time, right? Right? Have you ever prayed for God to come down? Maybe hitting a little too close to home, right? Well, that's praying as if God were absent, right? That's praying as if God were up there and not here. You ever prayed for God to show up? You ever said God showed up? I get what you mean, but maybe we should rethink that one, right? God is always present and at work. God's presence isn't something we attain. It's not something we achieve. God is already closer to us than we are to ourselves, and this just doesn't change. This is the whole scripture. God has been with us the whole time, and presence with us is the whole thing. It's the whole thing. Right? Creation is God's presence with Adam and Eve in the garden, and Adam and Eve's presence with each other, right? So there's this communion that's taking place in the garden. And right after they sin, what's the first thing that happens? God goes looking for them. Right? First words out of God's mouth, where are you? Where did you go? God goes looking for them, and this is the trajectory of the whole Bible. God looks for, searches for, seeks out his people because he wants to be with them. We could do a whole weekend on this, but you know, God visits Abraham as three travelers in Genesis 18. God visits Jacob in a dream, Genesis 28. Exodus 3, God visits Moses in the bush that won't burn up. God even speaks through donkeys in Numbers 22. God comes to his people in angels and through prophets, right? In the tabernacle and in the temple, all of these things. And ultimately in Jesus Christ, right? In Jesus Christ, God's permanent presence is realized among God's people. That Jesus Christ represents the incarnation, right? Emmanuel, God with us. This organic connection now between humanity and God is present in Jesus Christ, right? It wasn't just a one-off. That actually through Jesus Christ, we're connected to God. Through the flesh of Jesus, our flesh is connected to God. God's design has always been to bring heaven and earth together in new creation. This is what we see. This is how the Bible ends, right? Revelation 21, 22. The new Jerusalem comes down. God is with his people once again. So this, it's always been about presence. And in fact, God's never left. In a way, God's never left. It was we who turned away and began to go in a different direction. But God's always been seeking us out. This whole time, God is always present and at work. And even right now, Jesus Christ has ascended to heaven. He is a human being in heaven at God's right hand. But the Holy Spirit, right, has been sent. And so the Holy Spirit is this connection now that we have. Jesus promises in Matthew 28, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age. And so God is here. God's present. God's working in our lives, and each of us individually. He's present in this room. He's working tonight with us, you know, teaching us. God is always present and at work. So a couple of implications of this, and then I'd love to get some feedback from y'all. As I mentioned earlier, we should maybe rethink saying that God showed up. I think we should think about our language, right? Maybe rethink praying for God to come down. Praying for God to show up, saying that God showed up. Because if these assumptions are true, God doesn't show up. Rather, we wake up to the God who's always been there. So the process for us is not ramping up our spiritual fervor so God will come down and show up and do something. The process for us is waking up, noticing what's here. So it's changed. It's changed the way I pray. It's changed the way I talk about what happens when we worship. Our efforts in discipleship are never to get God's attention. We don't have to get his attention. To get him to come down, to get him to do something. In fact, that's how pagans relate to their God, right? Because remember in 1 Kings 18, I think it is, when the prophets of Baal are cutting themselves and shouting, Elijah's making fun of them a little bit. Right? I mean, he couldn't quite help himself. Like, maybe he's going to the bathroom, you know? Or like, you know, maybe he's in another wing of the house. Just got to shout a little louder. That's not what it's like for us in God. We aren't trying to get God to do something in our lives. He's already doing something. This changes everything about the way that we approach our spiritual lives, about the way we approach prayer, about the way we approach church, about the way we approach everything. If God's already here, and God's already working, do you feel that? Like, I just feel like the burden goes off my shoulders. Oh, okay. I can relax into something rather than grit my teeth and try for something. I can relax into something and notice what's happening here. Second implication, just because it feels like God is absent doesn't mean that's true. We trust Jesus' word to us. We don't trust our feelings about those things. And this can be a problem. I mentioned I was a worship pastor at the Charismatic Church. This can be a problem for people who associate God's work with strong emotions. If you associate God's work with some really cool feeling that you've had, the trick is oftentimes we can try to return to that feeling rather than settle into what is God doing now, right? Or we can assume that if I don't have that feeling, that God's not here, that God's not working, that God's not doing something. That's not true. Third implication about this is that the primary context of our discipleship is just our everyday lives then. Another mistake that I used to make is to think that I needed to go get some like mountaintop experiences if my spiritual fervor was running a little low. I needed a spiritual retreat. I needed a conference. You know, I needed an evening of worship music or something like that. All those things are great. I still like all of those things. But I've learned I can't use those things as like jet fuel for my spiritual life. Rather, my everyday life is what is the context for my discipleship. That's where God is present at work, because that's most of our lives, right? Most of our lives is just walking on a road. You know, it's not going up to a mountaintop. It's walking on a road, sometimes going through valley of suffering. But that's most of our lives. Fourth implication is this, that the mundane is just as important as the extraordinary. This is similar to the previous one. We tend to chase the extraordinary, you know, the miraculous, healings, you know, great feelings, you know, whatever it might be, mountaintop experiences, but most of our lives are just mundane. And that's where God meets us. So discipleship isn't just a program. It's not just what we do in our, what do you guys call them, home churches? It's not just what you do on Sunday morning. It's not just home church. It's not your discipleship isn't a program. Your discipleship is your life. And every part of it, you know? You guys mentioned that you were just sharing your struggles. We didn't think we were sharing struggles about faith. That's what I meant by that. Like, well, those are struggles with faith, because they're just struggles. Like, your everyday life is the life that you have, and that's the life that God's concerned with. That's the life that God is present in and wanting to affect. Okay? Quick story, and then I'm going to hear maybe where this is impacting you guys. So one illustration of this, my dad died when I was 25, suddenly heart attack, was, you know, completely unexpected. He was a good dad. He was a Christian guy, you know, led me to the Lord when I was just little. He helped to plant a church that I was part of when I was young, and he was a wise person. He was a good dad, you know. Part of my processing, you know, was actually feeling pretty angry at God about that, because, you know, I was like, there's a lot of crappy dads out there. Like, you know, why does my dad have to die? So ever since he died, I remember I didn't realize how much I had relied on him for wisdom. You know, I called him for advice all the time. But I didn't realize this until it was a few weeks after he had died, and I was talking with my mom on the phone. And I realized I sort of unconsciously asked her for the same kind of advice as I would ask my dad for. And I remember, like, my mom's wonderful, but she's like, she's not my dad. And she didn't do the same thing that my dad used to do, right? She just gave me, oh, yeah, that sounds hard. You know, like, that's all she gave me. Which I'm like, you know, which is great. Again, I'm not, no, there's no, you know, don't show my mom this, okay? So, no, I'm joking. But I, you know what I mean? What I'm saying is I realized, oh, I'm missing something now in my life. I'm missing this place that I used to go to say, here's what I'm wrestling with. Here's a decision I have. What should I do? And so I started praying for this. I started praying for a father figure. I started praying for somebody to mentor me in faith and life, you know, and wisdom. And I, you know, that was, I was 25 when I started praying for that. I'm 46 now, and so it never happened. I never got a father figure. And I was processing this a couple years ago with a therapist. And just talking with this therapist about this, and I was like, yeah, like, I've always wanted this, and I felt like I never got it. You know, I'm disappointed about that. I can't remember why we're talking about it. And my therapist was a Christian woman, and she proceeded to ask me. She said, you know, have you been any kind of a presence like that for anybody else? Like, have you been a presence? Have you been wisdom for people? Have you been able to do that for others? And I was reflecting a little bit, and I was like, yeah, I think there's some people who have said that, you know, I've been an important presence like that for them. And she just said, you know, it sounds to me like God was able to answer your prayer because the wisdom that you got came from somewhere, didn't it? So God answered your prayer. It just didn't come in the form that you expected. And it like altered my memory. Like, it altered the way that I looked at my whole life, because I realized that God had been, I had this consciousness that God had not given me the thing that I had prayed for. And technically, he hadn't. He hadn't actually given me a father figure. But somehow, God had been answering my prayer, even though it didn't come in the form that I had expected it to come in. And that's affected my prayer life ever since, because I think there's just a sense for me now of openness about, well, here's what I'm praying for. This is what I would like. But ultimately, there's just more trust for me, because I trust that God's probably answering my prayer. But if I cling really tightly to the form in which I want an answer, maybe I'll miss some of what God is actually doing. And so that brings me back to, God is always present and always working, even when we don't recognize it, when we don't understand it, even when we pray for something for 20 years and we can't, you know, we think God didn't answer our prayer, but in fact, God had been answering my prayer for all that time. So I don't know if that strikes anything for you guys, if that brings anything up for you. I'm going to talk a little bit about a practice that, at the end of the evening, a practice that we can engage in to help us notice some of these things. But maybe just open it up for questions. Does anybody have any questions? Does anybody have any reflections or observations that you want to share?
Has Justin demonstrated anything? Yes.
Sorry, what'd you say?
I was curious if Justin had done this training before, because this comes very concerned.
Oh, yeah, good. Yeah. Well done, yes. You get a cookie. Did he pay you to say that?
Oh, okay,
yeah. Get a picture of it.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, Justin has done this. Good. Anything else?
Something that I think about is, like, seeing God's presence with us here now, and you know he's working with you, but how do you deal with the emotion? Like, I think the thing that I've been struggling with is I see God's presence in every, you know, the journey, mm-hmm. but how do you not, I'm having a hard time seeing, finding joy within that journey. If that makes sense.
I think so, yeah.
It's like, how do you, you know, it's almost like we're in the desert, like the Israelites, and he's giving them, there's honey in the end, there's honey, just trust me, but they're just complaining and frustrated. It's like, I want to become that wise, humble, like, joyful person and not live in the other.
Yeah.
Anyways, it could just be that Enneagram 6 in me.
Yes. My wife's an Enneagram 6, so I guess.
Just seeing people like that in their faith, I was just solid wise, but yet joyful, even in suffering. Like, it's so hard in that suffering.
Yeah.
You can claim that suffering, but I don't know. Like, do you feel that you found freedom from after you heard that, like, not mad, like, that your dad passed away? Do you feel like you got back with that?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I think we'll come back to some of that in the third axiom. That's another thing about these axioms; they're not like isolated buckets of information. They're sort of interlocking, and they overlap with each other quite a bit. And so, we'll get to some of that. I think one of the things that's really important to recognize is that, like, being real about, this is actually the third axiom, but being real about where we're at is always the ground zero for transformation. It's just, you know, you can want, you know, joy, you know, in the midst of suffering, but if all you feel is anger, well, go ahead and feel the anger. Go ahead. Like, you probably need to feel it all the way, you know? That's what some of those imprecatory psalms are for, right? God gives us this faithful way of praying, which is basically like, it's kind of weird because God's like, here, tell me off if you need to. Here's some words. You know? Like, you want me to tell you off? Absolutely. If you need to, go ahead, right? God's not threatened by that. And that we actually need to do that, right? To get to that place that you want to get to, which is a beautiful place of wisdom and, right, there's joy in suffering. Like, we can't pretend that we're there if we're not. And so the place to be is the place you are, you know, whatever that is, and just embracing that. That's been important for me, to just embrace, especially like the negative stuff, right? The stuff I wish was different, because I feel some shame about it sometimes, right? And so I have grown, you know, in terms of, I mean, my dad died 21 years ago. And so, you know, I've had a lot of time to process, but I still feel sad occasionally, you know. I don't know that I'm angry anymore about that. But yeah, for me, part of my journey has been embracing sadness. I haven't let myself feel it. I think that didn't feel faithful to me, but I've had to, you know, so. So anyway, I don't know if that's an answer to your question, but part of what I've had to believe is God.
Not stay there. That's a, like, doesn't feel like always sad.
Yes.
Occasionally, everything doesn't come across that way. But, yeah. You know, just like a half class and be half class.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah.
Maybe some people are meant to be that way.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a hard question. Without knowing all the context, right?
Yeah. I work in the same. There's a lot of times when I catch myself and I'm like, I need to be half full, not half empty.
Yeah.
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 But if it weren't for the half people, the half full people would we'd get ourselves into trouble pretty consistently.
So
there's a like, I am not a half empty person. I've come to appreciate the half empty perspective.
Yeah.
Because if you can kind of find the middle, you have like a reasonably full glass, like a fair share. And it's kind of like there is some benefit to hearing that voice, but yeah. But conversely, like if you live half full all the time, then
yeah,
you tend to exhaust and annoy your close companions. So.
Sure. Yeah, I think for me it really does. And we're getting into some of the third axiom stuff, which is fine, but. The important thing is to be real about what is real, right? So what is happening, and not, because part of the reason that it's been helpful for me to get in touch with sadness is because that was a real part of me that I've been ignoring for a long time. And so, you know, without knowing more context, I don't know. You know, there could be there could be a case, right? There could be a case where it's like, no, it's actually really important to just get in touch with that sadness. And then there could be a case where you're actually maybe wallowing and cultivating sadness rather than getting in touch with joy that might be available to you, you know? And so I think it takes discernment, it takes discipleship, it takes other people walking with you to do that, because I've had, so for us, I'll just say this, our church plant, we have a lot of people who grew up in church cultures where a lot of spiritual bypassing took place. Spiritual bypassing is, I'm not going to embrace the ugly reality that I'm living in. Instead, I'm going to use like the Bible or a nice Christian phrase to sort of bypass my feeling, right? How are you doing? Better than I deserve, right? Well, that might be true, but like, are you bypassing, you know, something that's actually real where you need to maybe embrace what's really happening? So because of that, a lot of the freedom that we need to speak to people that come to our church is that it's okay to be sad. It's okay if you're having a bad day. It's okay that you didn't want to come to church today, but you're here. Like, but it's okay that, like, you know, you're grumpy right now. It's okay. So that's been a lot of what we say to people. Like, we proclaim that to people. But there are some glass half full people in our church who are like, oh, you guys are always sad, you know, like this is a sad church, you know. And I've actually had someone in one of my leadership cohorts who, like, one of his, we'll talk about this word here in a second, but Kairos's, was that he said, I don't feel like I have permission to be happy, but I genuinely feel happy. But when everybody else is sad, I feel like I'm not supposed to be happy. And so I stifle it. I don't express it. And so, but what I told him was, I actually want you to be wherever you're at. You know, like that's actually a gift. So this person's sadness is a gift to our community. Your happiness is a gift to our community. Just be where you're at, right? Just be where you're at. So anyway, that's a good question, Erica. Any other questions or just reflections about this?
This is one, every time I see this, I kind of think about Henry Blackaby, you know, experiencing God and how that concept was introduced to me when I first became a Christian. So I feel like I lucked out in that regard, I almost got a decent foundation for that concept that God is always with us. So I didn't come into it with this idea that God is far off and he's not and he's here. But when I look at that, I see the two aspects of God, that he's present and he's at work. So he's being and he's doing. And I know, kind of like glass half full, glass half empty people, there's also people that are more seers and people that are doers. I'm being a doer kind of person. And so I see that tension between God's the perfect aspect of both. You know, he wants you to abide, but he also wants you to go and do mission. And so I guess what my reflection on that is just that it helps me to frame my strength as well as my challenge. For me, that I may lean heavy on the side of doing. And so, but God is both, and I need to lean into that and kind of focus on but I like how in community we have people that are one or the other, lean one way or another, and I feel like that's a good way for us to challenge each other, because hopefully we'll have a whole group of doers, a whole group of beers, but that we do get a chance to kind of interact with each other and pull each other in those different directions.
That's good.
For me, it's good to just reflect personally where I stand, but
Also, that God designed us to be both. He is with us, but he's doing stuff. So there's those quiet times where he seems quiet to us, but he's still working. He's still doing both. You know, he's doing both perfectly, but I think that's a good to point out, that, like, sometimes the good news is that God is present. Right, and sometimes the good news is about, it does have to do with what God is doing. And this actually becomes a really important aspect for us in discerning mission as a community, as individuals, because the doers among us oftentimes can get out ahead. They can just start doing something because they're happy to do anything, right? And they get out ahead of God in a sense, because part of what we're discerning is God is present with us, but God is doing something among us, which means that maybe God's not doing other things among us. Like, what is God doing? And how do we join in that? How do we participate in that rather than do something and try to tug God into it, right? And so that becomes a really important aspect of this as well. That, you know, God's with us in the midst of this stuff, but he's doing something as well. And paying attention to that allows us to participate in it. We pay attention, we participate, we surrender, we submit to whatever God's doing. We'll talk about this later. This is Axiom 5, too. And whatever God is doing through us, which is normally what we think about in terms of the doing, God is also doing in us. So there's a coherence to what's happening. We'll talk more about that tomorrow. So. Good. Anything else? Okay. All right. So again, I just encourage you, as you listen to these axioms, just think about, you know, what's your reaction to this? What feelings does it provoke for you? Right? What would be different for you if you believed that this was true? My assumption is we sort of believe this is true, and then we also sort of don't believe this is true. That makes sense? That's how we believe. We believe things with our bodies, not just with our minds. And so a lot of times the things we think we believe are not the actual things that we believe, and our bodies tell us the truth. So what we do ends up telling us the truth about what we believe. And there's no shame in that. It's just a revelation. It's just like, oh, I guess I don't believe that God's present here because maybe you notice something about that. So that makes sense?